Welcome to the Accounting Web Tax Podcast with Anne Fairpo. Brought to you in association with CCH, part of Wolters Kluwer, number one in tax and accounting worldwide.
Hello and welcome to the Accounting Web Tax Podcast for Monday the 15th of October. What I'm going to be looking at today, the main thing is going to be the EU consultation on reduced VAT rates, wholly and exclusively on what it means for the sports world. There's some interesting cases here. The single compliance process, just an update of what's going on there, and then the usual round of snippets, a few bits and pieces that would come up this week. So, starting with the EU consultation on reduced VAT rates. This is a consultation actually launched by the Commission, not by the HMRC. It was launched on October the 8th, and it's being aimed at just about anybody and everybody, citizens, businesses and other stakeholders. We're being asked our opinion on a number of reduced VAT rates. Specifically, it's looking at three particular areas where the Commission thinks that reduced VAT rates need to be reviewed. Firstly, the question is any current reduced rate distorting competition within the single market? Secondly, looking at the list of goods and services which can benefit from a reduced rate, apparently this was agreed very many years ago, and policy has developed and changed since then, and so consultation wants to know whether some of these reduced rates now actually contradict EU policy objectives. Particularly what they're looking at here are those reduced rates for water, energy, waste management and housing. And then finally, wants to know how similar goods and services should be treated for VAT purposes, taking into account the changes in technology. Believe that might translate directly to the digitised goods problem. You know, here in the UK, if you buy a physical book, 0% VAT. If you buy a digitised book, 20% VAT. Slight difference. Just for background, the VAT directive requires member states to apply a standard VAT rate of at least 15%. There's actually no maximum, just that minimum. The current highest rate of VAT in the EU is currently Hungary's, slightly eye-watering 27%. Next time you think 20% is bad, have a think on that one again. However, EU countries do have the option of applying one or two reduced VAT rates, or possibly rather more than that if they want to. And there's minimum requirement of 5% for goods and services on a restricted list, which is annexed to the VAT directive. The list's supposed to be strictly interpreted so that member states can't actually apply a reduced rate to goods or services which aren't on the list. Not all countries pay as much attention to that as they might. Luxembourg in particular doesn't really seem to care and has brought in a 3% rate for supplies of digitised goods. Zero-rated supplies, by the way, are a concession wherever you see them, be they in the UK or anywhere else. They're a concession that was either negotiated directly with the EU or it was negotiated as part of the accession to the EU by a particular country. Anyway, this consultation is part of the sort of general process. The EU says it doesn't presuppose the elimination of any particular VAT reduced rate at this stage, although it does actually note that studies say that the standard rate could be reduced by up to 7.5 percentage points in some cases if all reduced rates were to be removed. Nevertheless, the EU Commission can only make proposals on possible abolition or introduction of reduced VAT rates. And even if the Commission were to try and make that proposal to get rid of a VAT rate, it would have to be unanimously endorsed by the member states before it could happen. So the EU says that the review of reduced rates will be a holistic and very inclusive one, which I believe may be translated as has a snowball's chance in hell of actually happening. Anyway, moving on to the here and now, sports and wholly exclusively, we've had a couple of recent cases which are interesting in the way that they go about things rather differently, in slightly different areas, but they're both looking at the question of what is and isn't wholly and exclusively for the purposes of the trade. Both cases look at Section 74 of ICTA because they've taken sufficiently long time to get through the tribunal system, but it's now Section 54 of the CTA 2009 following the rewrite. The principles are much the same, so the principles coming out of the cases can continue to be valid. The first case was Interfish. It was an additional hearing on further submissions, which was a first-tier tribunal looking at payments made for sponsorship of a club. And despite the further submissions, the tribunal has confirmed that the payments are non-deductible because there was a dual purpose in making them and that one of the taxpayers' purposes in making them was to improve the club's financial position, not solely for the purposes of the trade of the taxpayer. The further hearing, the further submissions, were looking at payments that might have included sums for direct promotion of the taxpayer to the public. The kind of thing the tribunal had in mind were logos on players' shirts. if some of those payments had been separately identified as being specifically for that kind of advertising, then they could have been deducted, according to the tribunal. But unfortunately, they said there was no evidence to support that division. And so there was this dual purpose to improve the financial benefit of the club by allowing it to enhance its team of players without incurring a deficit. The business Interfish making the payment did have an additional purpose in mind, which was, you know, having it hoped there'd be a knock-on effect of making the business look attractive to the other businesses that supported the club. But that wasn't the sole reason for the payment. The tribunal held there was this dual purpose of propping up the club, and so it wasn't allowable. But in interesting contrast, the $32 million that McLaren Formula One team paid the FIA, it's the governing body for Formula One, is apparently tax deductible because it's not a criminal fine. It's just a very large amount of money that the FIA demanded under the organisation's rules to allow McLaren to continue competing in Formula One after it had allegedly used unauthorised material about other teams' cars, which appears to be that it may have employed a few people from other teams and taken advantage of what they knew. Also, so seemed to be the view at the time, she says, hastily adding the required allegedly, as per have I got news for you. Anyway, McLaren wanted to deduct this $32 million as an expense of the business. HMRC were really rather less keen on the whole concept, and the case does actually go through all of the, well, not necessarily all of the, but quite a lot of case law looking at the tax deductibility of the fines. In that sort of context, it's actually quite an interesting case to read. It's good for looking at that history. Anyway, the position with regard to statutory penalties is pretty straightforward. They aren't tax deductible because, as a matter of policy, allowing the cost of a penalty to be effectively shared with other taxpayers by allowing the deduction is not regarded as a very good thing. It does dilute the point of the fine if it's not going to hit the bottom line quite as hard as it might otherwise do. It might have helped in this particular case, worth looking at some of the background, that the judge, Charles Hellyer, did look at the relevant FIA regulations and so on, and concluded that he thought that McLaren were actually only supposed to be paying about $50,000 of that particular fine, and that presumably it only paid the rest because it felt commercially obliged to do so. Interesting that he really thought that McLaren weren't going to dispute the other sort of, you know, 31 point something million pounds, but there we go. The more interesting things in this case, and I have to say, I suspect that the appeal may have gone in faster than somewhat from HMRC, is the comments from the judge such as, profit-making activity carried on by McLaren was not limited to acting within the confines of the Concord Agreement, which is the FIA agreement, and could include cheating. That activity was its trade. I think the judge just said that Formula One's trade includes cheating, which would be an interesting concept. But maybe that is it. He goes on to say, an understanding that fraud or deceit might be found not to be part of a trade which depended on probity or trust. That's fine, but he could see no compelling reason for finding that McLaren's trade was so limited. So that's all right then. More usefully, his comment that even if these activities were not normal or ordinary, they were nevertheless activities so closely associated with the mainstream of McLaren's trade that he couldn't say they weren't part of it, might be of help in future, although, as I say, the appeal is almost certainly underway. I can't see HRC standing for this result, in particular because there was actually a dissenting wing member in this particular here. Charles Hellyer was the presiding member of the tribunal. It was a two-member panel, and in that case, the presiding member has a casting vote. The other member of the panel, Nicholas D, was not quite so keen on the concept and, in fact, disagreed completely with Hellyer. But as he got the casting vote, the case has gone through to this one. Basically, Hellyer seems to have been rather reluctant to extend the principle relating to tax deduction of statutory fines to cover non-statutory fines or payments, contractual payments, which are not designed to protect the public and where there's no specific public concern. In particular here, the fine wasn't addressed by an external body. The agreement under which the fine arose, the Concord Agreement, is one which the F1 teams have together agreed to be bound by. It's not something external to them, imposed upon them, and that seemed to be his distinction here. It'll be interesting to see what the upper-tier tribunal makes of it. Moving on, the single compliance process, we've had a briefing paper update from HMRC. You'll remember the single compliance process is this latest G-Wiz testing by HMRC, which is apparently aimed at improving the quality and consistency of HMRC inquiry work by adopting a more collaborative approach with business and their agents. Note the order in which they put that, it's important. and it's supposed to increase the efficiency and effectiveness of their workforce, reducing unnecessary delays and focusing solely on the aspects that HMRC needs to. That's the theory at any case. HMRC says they envisage the SCP as a single framework within which the majority of SME business compliance checks in future will be undertaken. It's a five-stage process, common to most inquiries, they say, and they've said that there are going to be four different approaches within the framework with varying amounts of time spent on each case, and they're looking at various trials and pilots to see how well the design actually works in achieving this. They say that the SCP is one of a range of approaches that could be used as a balanced response to their assessment of risks and behaviours. They say other responses, approaches could be campaigns, task force and business record checks. Campaigns and task force are generic. I mean, they're not aimed at specific individuals, whereas the SCP and largely the business records checks are aimed at specific taxpayers. There's nothing like campaigns and task forces. Although I suppose once they've got a campaign going, once they identify the individuals, then they could use it. But it's still an odd way of looking at it. Nevertheless, they do say that it's important to distinguish between the single compliance process and the business records checks. Apparently they're completely different approaches. They say the business records check is a risk-based compliance check carried out in real time to establish that adequate business records are being maintained in accordance with statutory requirements, and it's not a check into business tax affairs. They've put that in writing. Worth remembering it if you do start to get business record checks and you want to make sure that they're staying within their parameters. The single compliance process, in contrast, is the method or approach that they're going to use to conduct compliance checks into a business tax affairs, looking at specific risks identified. Although, you know, you're looking at still looking at task forces and even compliance centres, they say. You know, for a business having identified risks, how is that supposed to help a compliance centre generally? I mean, it's fine once you've identified a risk, but the compliance centre overall, it doesn't entirely make sense. The process is designed to look at solely those risks or behaviours that are identified for inquiry. And there are four levels of checks which are appropriate to those risks. And they range from basic compliance checks where there's no need for a face-to-face meeting through to compliance checks with characteristics that require an evasion process. So where you fall on that four-stage process will depend on exactly what they end up doing. And they've said that each of those levels, they have an estimated maximum time to work on the inquiry. At level one, which is the no need for face-to-face meeting, etc., it's 1.5 days. The evasion approach, 8 days. I find that interesting that they think compliance checks with characteristics requiring an evasion approach will take only 8 days to complete. I'm assuming that doesn't mean consecutive 8 days, the amount of time that HMRC officers will actually spend working through the inquiry overall. The idea behind this process is it's supposed to improve the quality and consistency of inquiry work by adopting a more collaborative approach with business and the agents. Fine. One of the problems that may need to be addressed as part of this pilot and looking at the trials, etc., is a suggestion that HMRC may contact businesses directly to arrange an inquiry, apparently bypassing the agent who will only be copied in rather than informed in advance. Now, for those agents that do a lot of compliance work with clients and a lot of other work, your clients are effectively paying you to manage the HMRC process. Having a phone call out of the blue on VAT and other indirect taxes is not really going to help that very much. Direct tax cases, contact apparently will be by letter and not by telephone call. The agent will be copied in on the letter at the same time. So there's still a reasonably good chance that the letter may get to the client before it gets to the agent, hence a stroppy phone call to the agent from, imagine this from a number of clients effectively saying, what's all this about, what do I pay you for? Trial phase is apparently being further extended to allow testing of some of the more technically complex compliance checks. The whole thing was originally announced, you'll remember, in May 2011, and it's been extended and extended, and now basically adds a third trial phase heading through until December, leading to potential implementation depending on trial outcomes, although HMRC say that a further testing should not be seen as any indications any assumptions have been made on the future of SCP. Hopefully, part of all of this will be a change to this particular prospect of contacting businesses with 64 aids in place before contacting their agents. And finally, we'll look at snippets. few things quickly. First off, toasted sandwiches. It is VAT. Subway have lost again. The upper tier tribunal is no more impressed with meatball sandwiches than the first tier tribunal were. Apparently toasted and meatball marinara sandwiches, which sound horribly messy, are hot food, heated in order to be eaten at above room temperature, no matter what the subjective intention of the vendor was. Apparently her evidence was that she heated the fruit to demonstrate that it was freshly cooked. There's quite a lot of decent analysis of the case law in the judgment, again, although changes on law on hot food that came in at the beginning of October mean that it's all a bit moot, in fact. Next up, the proposals that there should be CGT-exempt employee share ownership. George Osborne's announced his latest wheeze for employee-employer relationships, which is this proposal that employees could, or more accurately, may have to for new jobs, sign away some employment rights, such as the right to redundancy pay or to sue for unfair dismissal, in exchange for shares in the employer company. Any growth in value of the shares would be exempt from CGT, although it appears that the original acquisition might not be free from income tax and NICs, which seems rather helpful and may kill the thing at birth. I watched this space of the consultation. All well and good, and the Institute of Directors was welcomed it. CBI seems a little more circumspect, but it does really look to me rather more like it'll simply exchange an argument about employment rights in the employment tribunal for an argument about share valuation in another court when things go wrong. There's also some question as to exactly what scope the UK has for allowing employees to give up some of these rights. Many employment rights derive from EU law and may not be quite so easily overridden as the government might like. And finally, the annual paper filing arrangements for employers who object to filing online on religious grounds, i.e. the Plymouth Brethren, are to be retained for another year through to April 2014, but it seems that thereafter they'll have to report in real time on paper. An interesting concept. And with that, I'll leave you for the week. Have a good week.